welcome to Temple of Health Radio Show. This is Dr. Susan Kolb, and today I'm pleased to have as my guest Dr. Joe McCullough, who is worldwide famous for his newsletter and website, a champion of holistic and alternative health care. And today we're going to be discussing food choices, healthy food choices. And Dr. McCullough has been involved in the California proposition, I don't remember the number of it, but the one that was trying to get GMO food labeled, which I think is an excellent idea. In Europe, they have gotten it labeled. We still have to do that in the United States. And we'll be talking a little bit about that as well as other things you need to consider with your food choices. Welcome, Dr. McCullough. Thanks for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me, Susan. Dr. Kolb.
So would you like, you can call me Susan. I'll call you Joe.
Okay.
Would you like to tell the listening audience a little bit about your newsletter and website with all of the videos? Because you interview just about everybody in holistic and alternative and medicine and have YouTube videos up with their interviews.
Well, I was trained as a family physician, and my passion was trying to stay healthy, and I've studied about 25,000 patients over 20 years before I combined it with another one of my passions, which is technology, and basically we have a process where we search about 1,000 articles a day in the health literature to find the best in the information that's out there to keep people healthy in a natural way, and also to document some of the challenges with the traditional and conventional medical approaches. So we put that together in a newsletter, and it goes out every day, and we've been doing that for about 17 years or so, and now it's the most viewed natural health letter in the world. We're actually, I think we're number 4 or 5 in the world for the just health sites. So we've got a number of people who view us and read our content and take that information and use it for to help them and their families take control of the health.
Yeah, I've been a subscriber for a while, and I've it has information that I don't know, so that would indicate that people need to keep track of it because you do present the information first and foremost. It's very good.
Well, it's a moving target. You know, it's not like there's some basics, of course, that we'll hopefully review those today, that if you apply, you'll certainly move your body towards health. But there's new things that are always discovered that's evolving. So it's somewhat of a moving target, and we seek to do the best we can at highlighting and digesting that information in a way that people can easily understand.
So would you like to start off by giving your website where people can sign up for your newsletter?
Sure. It's my last name, which is Mercola, MERCOLA.com.
Right.
Or they just type in Google and it'll come right up.
Yeah. Right. Well, I guess we can start with some of the principles that you've learned over the years to help people stay healthy. I'm not real healthy today because I have a cold, but my diet hasn't been the best, and so we can talk about what you can do with your diet to stay healthier.
Well, sure, especially this time of year, your cold may be related to the fact that we're just emerging from winter, so most people don't have a chance to get outside, and you're in Atlanta, so you have a little more sunshine than most of the other country, but even then, it's still hard. If you don't get natural sunshine on your skin on a regular basis, you'll tend to be low in vitamin D. And yes, you can take oral vitamin D supplements. It's probably not a bad idea for many, but ideally it's best to get it the way our ancestors did, which is to expose our skin to the sunshine. This provides probably better benefits, and that's a really potent way to decrease your risk for loads of infection. But another way is to really do something basic, which is basically cut down on the sugar. Because when you have sugar, it tends to do a number of negative components to your health, one of which is to suppress your immune system. It does it in a variety of ways. One of the more important ways is to negatively influence your gut health. It promotes the growth of disease-causing bacteria, pathogenic bacteria, and it actually reduces the beneficial bacteria. And they have a phenomenal influence on the quality of our immune response. So it's when we get coughs, colds, and flus in the winter, it's not necessarily related to the infection. Obviously, you have to have the infection to get sick, but it's more typically related to a depressed immune response. And you can do that by really minimizing the amount of sugar and getting lots of sun exposure and having a good exercise program, along with getting plenty of sleep. You could have the healthiest lifestyle and eat the best foods on the planet, but if you're not sleeping well, that'll also severely impair your immune response.
Yeah, I think I had a combination of too much sugar, not exercising, and not enough sleep all at one time, which is unusual, but I did have that for about 2 days prior. I got sick on Valentine's night. So too much sugar in the office on Valentine's Day.
Yeah, so when you get sick, I like to look at those symptoms as really useful and potent feedback so that you can understand your body's giving you a signal. And ideally, if you listen to and are sensitive enough, you can modify what you've done or are doing on a regular basis so that you could improve your health for the long term. So that an illness doesn't necessarily have to be a bad thing. You know, one of the principles I like to apply in life is that of an inverse paranoid, and that is that the universe is conspiring to make you better. And it's something that happens to you that may appear to be bad superficially, more than likely, the long term is going to, it's actually going to be for your benefit.
I think that I know all the principles. It's just that sometimes it's hard to avoid certain exposures, you know, because you're in a social situation. Or my friends brought over, sodas and pizza, which I normally don't eat, and I ate that within hours of getting sick. So I think you're right.
Yeah, and here's another strategy, because I would say virtually everyone listening to this program has enzymes in their body that are more adapted to burning carbohydrates as your fuel. See, there's only two fuels that your body can use for burning to obtain energy, and that is carbohydrates and the other is fat. You can burn proteins, but it's really converted to carbohydrates. So the two primary fuels are carbohydrates and fat. And almost everyone is more adapted to burning carbohydrate, and that is a problem. And it's certainly not what our ancestors were adapted to. They were adapted to more burning fat. And when you're adapted to burning carbohydrate, there's a negative influence on the enzymes that are responsible for burning fat. So even though you may be overweight and heavy and be carrying an extra 30, 40, 50 pounds of fat, pure fat that is really shouldn't be there, these enzymes are down-regulated to burn the fat because you're adapted to burn carbs. And as a result, even though the fat is there, you don't burn it. You just simply are incapable of burning it. So if you'd like, I could offer some useful strategies to help your listeners shift over to burning fat. Would that be something that would be useful?
Yeah, that would be very useful.
So the first way, and it's not becoming very popular, is something called intermittent fasting. Because I like to apply health principles to the practices that our ancestors essentially followed. And I've developed a term for that, which is called RAP, or to replicate ancestral practices. And, you know, one of the simple ones, as we mentioned earlier, is to get outside in the sunshine. Sort of an extension of that is to walk outside without any shoes on and connect to the ground. And when you do that, that's something that we call earthing. And there's this transfer of free electrons into your body that can really serve as a very potent antioxidant stimulus and also decrease inflammation and thin your blood, which can really be useful for preventing disease and optimizing your health. So what one of those ancestral practices is that our ancestors, and in many people in the world today, probably a significant percentage of the population of the planet, does not have access to food 24/7 like we do in this country. You know, they it's just not an option. They go through regular periods of fasting, and salmon, where most of us are in a constant feast mode. And our body, you know, if we give it ourselves its tens of thousands or a few hundred thousand years, it wouldn't necessarily be a problem, but our genes and our biochemistry isn't adapted to that. We're adapted to more or less going through these cycles of fasting. So when we don't do that, then that causes these enzymes to be more geared to burning the carbohydrates, because we really can't store a heck of a lot of carbohydrates. We can store fat as fuel a lot more efficiently. But we have a limited store of carbohydrate, usually with muscle and liver glycogen. And it probably doesn't last for much more than a day, probably less than a day. And your body has the ability to replenish that when it gets fuel, and ideally convert the fat stores into the glycogen. But if you give it food all the time, especially in carbohydrate form, then it keeps those glycogen stores full, and it tends to not readily use the system to burn fat. So one of the simple ways that you can do is just avoid food for like 12 to 16 hours. And the simplest way to do that is to avoid breakfast. And I know that may sound surprising, excuse me, for some people, because we're taught that breakfast is the most important meal of the day. But I've come to learn that is not necessarily true for most people, and that eliminating breakfast, especially in our country, because most breakfast foods are notoriously unhealthy. Pancakes, waffles, breads, toast, jelly, jams. They're just really not a lot of good choices. Donuts, of course, another common breakfast food, or pastries. So when you eliminate that, you can combine the fact that you've been sleeping for about 8 hours or so, and then you combine another 6 hours on top of that, or 7 hours, or eight, and then you're really having a significant fast, which allows your body to deplete your glycogen stores and to start upregulating the enzymes to burn fat. It also helps if you don't eat 3 hours before you go to sleep. That even extends it further.
Right.
And then it gives your body a chance to not be busy digesting food while you're sleeping.
Yeah, I spent most of my life doing that, not eating breakfast, and often not eating until about 4 or 5 in the afternoon, because, as you know, when you go into surgery, you sometimes don't get out for 8 to 10 hours. And so I would often not eat, until later in the afternoon. And I think I'm glad to hear you say that, because I spent most of my life doing that.
Yeah, it's a good practice to get into. And when your enzymes are upregulated to burn fat, the reason I went down that path is that when you mentioned earlier you were in this social situation where you didn't really have a lot of choice, you had soft drinks and pizza. And if you're hungry, you know, hunger is a very, very difficult it's not a feeling, but it's a sensation to suppress.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it really is almost impossible. And there's a number of people can exert incredible willpower and discipline, but hunger is a powerful, motivating influence. And if you're feeling hungry, you're going to want to have that fuel that's sitting before you, especially
right.
if it tastes good. So, but the interesting component, and hunger is a clue, because if you're hungry, you should be eating. But it's again, that feedback that your body gives you, it could be a very significant clue that something needs to shift. Because if you're craving carbohydrates all the time, then you may want to consider an alternate strategy that I'm discussing to help you get away from that. And that's really one of the most I hesitate to use it, but I think it really is accurate in this term. It's almost magical side effects of this process, is that these cravings for these junk foods, the sugars and the bread, the pasta, cereal, rice, potatoes, and really processed and junk foods tend to disappear. And you feel okay. And when you're in these social situations where those foods are presented, yes, it would taste good and you would enjoy it, but you're not the hunger, that gnawing desire to engage and taste and have those foods isn't there. You're actually okay with just having a glass of water or just not eating anything. And when you've gotten to that point, then, you know, you really succeeded, because it really is difficult in social situations to not engage in those foods and partake in those foods, rather.
Yeah, I probably should have started fasting on Valentine's Day. That probably would have been the good thing to do.
Well, it's a good point, too, because this process of intermittent fasting is something that you don't do in a day or 2 days.
Uh-huh.
It usually takes several weeks, and there is a transition period where you're slightly uncomfortable because you're transitioning into the process of burning fat. And one of the fuels that we recommend people consider using is coconut oil. Coconut oil is a medium-chain triglyceride, and it's a very easily digestible fat. It's actually 50% of the fat is lauric acid. And lauric acid is something that's not typically available in the human diet. The primary source in human nutrition is really breast milk. And the reason why that's important, it's a really potent antimicrobial action. So it can help kill a lot of nasty bacteria that get wind up in your body. But anyway, in this context, it's also easily broken down to energy, so that this lack of energy and this hunger feeling can really be improved quite a bit by the use of coconut oil. So anyway, the whole process is if you have this situation coming up where you need to be fat adapted, you have to know it's not going to happen in a day. It's a process that it can take a few weeks to a few months, depending on how impaired your diet is currently.
So do you suggest doing the intermittent fasting every day or just every few days?
Well, I don't think anyone knows the right strategy for that. There's a lot of written on the topic. Some people recommend 2 days a week, some people every other day, or some people every day. I personally find it useful every day, but I don't get obsessive with it if there's situations where, you know, it just makes sense to be eating in a different pattern than I would do that. But I tend to gravitate towards an everyday intermittent fasting where I skip breakfast on a regular basis. And it's been very liberating. And it just makes life a lot easier, especially when you're traveling. You know, because when you're traveling on a plane, really, especially the airport food typically is not very good. I mean, there's not really a lot of good options. Occasionally, you'll get lucky and find a few. But for the most part, it's food sources that are going to decrease your health, improve it. So if you're adapted to burning fat, you don't mind going fasting. And one of the keys to this, too, is to make sure that I mentioned earlier it's important to cut down sugar, but in along with that would be some of the carbohydrates like grains and pastas, rice, cereal, potatoes, toast, bread, those types of foods. But it's not just eliminating that, because you still need calories. You have to get fuel. So it's replacing those calories with healthy fat. And by healthy fat, I just don't mean any type of fat. I mean to avoid, obviously, fried foods and food that is for decades has been promoted as being healthy, which was the vegetable oils, these omega-6 vegetable oils, which really almost all of us have too much of. So cutting back on those, that would be things like soy oil and corn oil, and replacing them with healthy fats like avocados, butter, coconut oil, olives, olive oil, and eggs would be another good source. So those types of fats, we replace it. Oh, and nuts. And this is the reason I was going there, macadamia nuts, specifically because of all the nuts, macadamia nuts have the lowest amount of protein, the lowest amount of carbohydrate, and the highest amount of fat. Fat that's very similar to olive oil fat. It's monounsaturated fat. So it's if you can travel with some macadamia nuts, they're a little pricey, but they tend to really provide a phenomenal snack food that's not going to impair your metabolic activity.
Yeah, just don't get them chocolate covered, huh?
No. Not unless you want to increase your risk for getting coughs, colds, and flu.
Right.
But it's amazing. Once you're fat adapted, the desire for those chocolate covered macadamias, they would taste good. No one's going to deny that would still, you get some satisfaction from having them. But that desire, that cravingness, that got to have it, that that sensation is just gone. It's like a monkey off your back. Yeah. It's just amazing once you transition to fat burning mode.
Well, there's a theory that if you eat a lot of carbohydrates and sugar, you get a lot of yeast overgrowth, and then the yeast starts eating the sugar in the bloodstream, and you get hypoglycemic, and then you crave sugar. So
that's one of the ways that I think I'm a firm believer in the importance of optimizing your gut health and the balance of good bacteria in there. And that's probably one of the most important ways that sugar damages your body, is that it really is a potent negative influence on the beneficial bacteria in your gut, and it really does lead to pathogenic organisms, especially the yeast and the fungi.
Yeah, and yeast can produce alcohol and aldehydes. There's actually a report in the Japanese literature of someone who had bad candidiasis that produced alcohol, and they had a fairly significant blood alcohol level without drinking alcohol. You know that?
Oh, sure.
The fuzzy feeling in your brain. Yeah.
Dr. Crook, William Crook, who passed away about somewhere between 5 and 10 years ago, and really one of my early mentors, had written a number of books, the classic one being The Yeast Connection, and I think he documented the same process in that book.
Yeah, so, and you don't feel well when you have yeast overgrowth. You feel poisoned. You feel like you wake up feeling bad, muscle-ache, mental clouding, fatigue. So those are all signs that you probably need to change your diet and take probiotics and, look at other anti-yeast measures.
Yes, indeed. So, I'm not a big believer necessarily taking medications to treat the yeast. I think the most potent and powerful way is with your diet. In fact, interestingly, that is how I transitioned from traditional medicine into natural medicine, was through that process. And I initially started to try to treat yeast in 1985, fresh out of med school in my residency program. I fully embraced the drug model and put people on these very potent antifungals to treat the yeast, and didn't really pay attention to the diet. And lo and behold, it didn't work. So I dismissed that approach.
Yeah.
I dismissed the whole concept of yeast being an issue. And then, fortunately, 6 or 7 years ago, or 6 or 7 years after that time, I re-explored it, and this time engaging the diet, and it made a tremendous difference. So the diet is really the crucial key to that.
And one of the aspects the diet has is foods are either more acid or alkaline-forming, and that affects your pH of your body, and that can be very important, too.
Mm-hmm. Yes, indeed.
So what are some of the other things that you recommend in terms of diet, water intake, that sort of thing?
Well, one of the ones, the recent appreciations that I've come to learn in the last year or so is that we've long been advocating the use of restricted carbohydrates. And the best carbohydrates, of course, being vegetables, ideally locally grown or even grown yourself if you can, and organic. So having that on a regular basis is a useful strategy, and staying away from the grains, which tend to turn to sugar pretty quickly and feed that yeast that we were talking about. So that's a useful strategy. But when people do that, it's a typical approach that when that's described, people think of the Atkins diet. And so there's really only three classes of nutrients that we have, which is carbs, proteins, and fats. So when you reduce carbs, you have to replace it with something. So there's a tendency for many people to replace it with lots of protein. So an Atkins is considered a low-carb, high-protein frequently, not necessarily high-fat. And I think that's learning to appreciate that that's a mistake, that protein is important, and we need to have some every day. But if you overdo the protein, that could be maybe every bit as damaging, if in some cases even more damaging than the carbohydrate. So because this protein stimulates a pathway that has been recently discovered about 7-8 years ago called the mTOR. And mTOR is short for mammalian target of rapamycin. And rapamycin is a cancer drug. And this pathway is an important pathway, and it's an ancient pathway, but it's just only recently been discovered. And it has an enormous influence on cancer growth, but also cellular growth. So it's the one pathway that gets stimulated when you're trying to build muscles when you're doing weight training. So there's this balance between building your muscles and cellular growth and also increasing too much growth, which is, of course, cancer. So excess protein tends to feed that quite a bit. So it's a balance, and you certainly need enough protein, because if you don't get protein, your body's going to start breaking itself down, and it'll break your bone down, your muscles, and that's certainly not good. But if you get too much, it can be a problem too. So the nutrient that seems to be relatively neutral, it doesn't stimulate this or stimulate sensitivity to your insulin leptin receptors, which is, you know, these are important hormone control systems that your body has to really establish harmony in your body. And if those aren't balanced well, then it'll increase pretty much almost every degenerative disease that we know of, and including aging. It's like pressing the accelerator down on aging when you've got those insulin leptin resistance pathways that are not signaling correctly. So the lower protein intake seems to be useful when you're in addition to lowering the carbohydrate, and that's really so. Then you're really left with the fat, and that's why focusing, and you know, I've come to appreciate that focusing on the healthy fat may be one of the most important ways that you can really improve your health, is to make sure that you're getting things like the coconut oil and butter and olives and the macadamia nuts and avocados. That would be another good source of fat. So yeah. And you know, so having these on a regular basis and making them be a large percentage of your calories can go an enormous way towards shifting these pathways that lead to disease and ill health.
So what are the factors that influence leptin, the so-called fat hormone?
Well, they're almost identical to insulin. So even though leptin is responsible for controlling fat, it's almost the same strategy that is used to control leptin as it is for insulin. And that would be, there's a number of ways that you can impair that. One is the most common, of course, is eat too many carbohydrates. But also, if you're not sleeping well, that will also impair it. So not enough sleep is a common way and recently appreciated risk factor for developing type 2 diabetes.
Right.
So you need at least 6 hours. If you're getting less than 6 hours on a regular basis, you are asking for trouble. And probably ideal is closer to 8. There are some really interesting new technology. I'm a real big fan of technology, but there's this sensor that's called Zeo. Z as in zebra, EO. You can get it pretty much anywhere. Amazon to simply get it in, but it's a headband that you wear at night, and it actually senses the amount or how well you're sleeping, objectively determines that, and records when you go to sleep, when you wake up, how many times you wake up during the night, how long you wake up, how much deep sleep you have, how much REM sleep, how much light sleep. And then it calculates all those and gives you a cumulative score so you can see how well you're doing. And I've been playing with it for about 2 years now, and it's just, it's almost impossible to get a good score unless you're getting at least 7 hours of sleep. And the closer you get to 8, the better that score becomes. So that, you know, that's an important strategy. It's simple, and if some of us don't have that opportunity to get good sleep because we have these night jobs or woken regularly. But when you do that, you're just going to compromise your health. So you want to really strategize a process so that you can really optimize your sleep as much as possible on a consistent basis. That's a simple, virtually free way of improving your health.
I noticed that once I started using this thing that covers your eyes at night, that I seem to sleep better.
One good strategy. You know, that's another good point. There's, you know, you should sleep in the dark. That's pretty well documented for a number of reasons. The pineal gland makes a hormone, important hormone called melatonin, which is really crucial for minimizing the growth of cancers. And your pineal makes it when you have exposure to lots of bright sunshine in the day, but also really pitch blackness at night. So if you've got light coming through your window, which is, you know, most people live in an urban area, so it's real common for that to happen, then that could easily impair your body's ability to produce melatonin. So, you know, it would be really a useful strategy if you're in your bedroom to make sure that you've got the blackout drapes or shades to implement that. And sometimes you have to put tracks around the edges so that the light doesn't seep through. Otherwise, you get a blackout shade, but if it's still going to have a perimeter of light seeping through unless you've got that track installed. Along those lines, too, you know, sleep is crucial. So there's a large, I think probably the majority of communities in the country don't have codes that require the electricians to run the wiring in the walls through conduit. And when you have wires in the wall that aren't run through conduit, it can produce magnetic field. And this is, you can check for these with a simple gauss meter. But if you have or if you have a refrigerator on the other side of your bedroom wall, you know, there's a large motor with a magnet, that can produce really high EMFs, or even these smart meters, if your bedroom is unfortunately next to an electrical meter, that can be another challenge. You want to make sure you're sleeping in a relatively electrically neutral environment.
You can use an alarm clock with a battery in it rather than a one plugged in.
You could. I have found some of the newer ones, especially with the LED, tend not to be that bad. I have one next to my bed that's actually 2 feet from my head, and I've measured it, and there's no EMFs coming from it. But a gauss meter is a useful tool to pick up. The most popular one is called the tri-field meter. You can pick it up on Amazon for $150. But it's something that I think I've had mine for more than 10 years. They really just require a simple 9-volt battery, and let it jump on it. It's not going to break. So it's something that, you know, as you move between different houses, or you're looking at your car or your office, let your friends use it. It's a very useful tool. I wind up using it several times a year. So it's a very neat gadget to kind of keep your body optimized. And then when you're sleeping too, not only can you minimize the EMF exposure, but then you can also engage in something called grounding. You can sleep on sheets that are grounded by either attaching it into a wall outlet with a special setup, or you can actually put it into a grounding rod into the earth. So, and then you get that free flow of electrons into your body. It's like taking antioxidants on a regular basis. So. And there's no charge for that. You know, it's free. It's nice.
Right.
It's one of the things we focus on our site is to have simple and expensive strategies that can help you prevent or help you minimize reliance on the conventional approach, which is pretty much an expensive drug that's loaded with side effects as a solution for all your health or disease symptoms.
That's true. Right. It's not particularly effective at that.
Well, you know, they may be effective. They may be very effective, and that's why some of these drugs works. I mean, it's an interesting model. They use them because they work, but they almost every single one of them, without exception, fails to address the cause of the problem.
Right. They just but if the pathway is disrupted long enough, side effects are going to happen. That's the problem. The better the drug interrupts the pathway, the more the side effects. That's the other thing. if you look at different pathways, different drugs that do a great job, like, you know, Vioxx in the arachidonic acid pathway did a great job, whereas Motrin doesn't do a very good job. Vioxx was causing a lot more side effects.
Yeah, I was actually warned in my newsletter that Vioxx was going to kill a lot of people in 1999, which is actually before it was brought onto the market. There
really?
Were some initial studies that suggested that. And sure enough, it wound up killing 60,000 people before Merck voluntarily removed it. And now we're actually going to post another article on this diclofenac, which is not commonly used in this country, but it's another NSAID, an anti-inflammatory, that is commonly used and over-the-counter in Europe. It's causing similar problems, and they're finding the same issues, and it's killing tens of thousands of people over there. So it's probably been taken off
the
market.
What's the name of it again?
Diclofenac, I think it's Voltaren is the brand name here.
Yeah, so that's something to watch out for
another
when you're traveling.
Yeah.
So one of the interesting things with food these days is to understand if there's any genetically modified influence on the food. And Whole Foods recently issued a statement that because of all the complexity of everything, it could not guarantee that the food on its shelf did not have GMO influence. So that's a very interesting statement by probably the country's largest whole and health food store, that it can't guarantee that anymore. You want to address that a little bit?
Well, as far as I understand, 70% of their food, of the items they sell in the store, are not organic and may in fact be contaminated with genetically modified ingredients. So, in theory, they're in favor of that, but the practical reality is they really haven't assisted too much in the process of helping consumers identify which foods, in fact, are contaminated with GMOs. There's not a really significant economic benefit for Whole Foods to do that, since the majority of the food they sell is contaminated. So it's a bit of a challenge, but I think we'll get there eventually. I think the writing's on the wall. And even though the California ballot initiative failed in November, it didn't fail by very much. And there are a number of initiatives in other states. And I'm pretty convinced that the state of Washington next year will pass a similar initiative and be one of the first states. It almost has to be done through a ballot initiative because the tremendous revolving door between industry and these federal regulatory agencies like the USDA, the White House, the judiciary, they seem to be seated with a number of former Monsanto vice presidents or people of significant influence in the organization. So they tend to control these agencies. And so seeking to pass any federal legislation is just almost never going to happen because of these influences.
Right.
So they're pretty clever, and they've got those bases covered. But the citizen ballot initiative is a really democratic workaround that we have to help people understand what's in their food so they can have a right to choose whether or not they want to consume it.
Yeah, I've interviewed Jeffrey Smith on this show on Seeds of Deception and Genetic Roulette, and it's just really amazing to me how the limited number of studies that exist showed problems. And these are almost all animal studies because the human studies really were never done. And I think if you look at the facts and how Monsanto handled everything, basically the FDA said it was up to Monsanto to prove that they were safe. And, it was just a very, very interesting history of how regulatory agencies just sidestep regulating a whole food industry.
Well, Monsanto is very clever. This is a company that created Agent Orange and dioxin, Yeah. They've got a, they have a significant history with them, but they also have been around for 100 years, and they, you know, they understand how the process works. So that's why they've infiltrated these agencies with their proponents and people who've been employed by them either in the past or in the future. It's interesting when you look at this. It's a literal revolving door. I mean, either the people were prominent in the organization, like even the former vice, one of the Supreme Court Justices, Clarence Thomas, was a prior attorney that worked for Monsanto. So, you know, they feed these people throughout the agencies, and they understand that's the way the system works, and the agencies make the rules. And once you've got those bases covered, it's very difficult to make any changes. But they did that early on, too. They knew that. And they made the rules that you didn't have to get this thing passed. It wasn't a drug. And essentially, they had the FDA come up with a statement in the 90s that it was essentially substantially equivalent to food. So, therefore, no studies were required. And it would be nice if you could show us that it was safe, but you don't have to.
Right.
And then they proceeded to make tens of billions of dollars from the process.
So, in your opinion, are there corn, sources of corn that are definitely not contaminated with GMO, or do you think that?
Oh, sure. I don't think until this year that most food corn that you would buy in the store to eat is GMO. I mean, most of the corn. There's a large percentage. I think 85% or so of the corn is GMO, but most of that is feed corn for cattle or for livestock, or for making biodiesel fuel. But the actually GMO corn for human consumption, I don't think it's yet to be widely adopted. But I'm not a big fan of corn anyway. I don't think it's a food that's really good for humans, for the most part. It's one of those grains. It's not really, I mean, people view it as a vegetable, but really it's more of a grain. That's the way it functions in the body, and grain is like a sugar. So I pretty much stay away from corn for the most part, and I think most people benefit if they follow a similar approach.
What grains do you recommend?
Well, I don't recommend many grains. My first book, it was a New York Times bestseller, was A Known Grain Diet. I think that you can use them, but, you know, it's just not... It's less than optimal, put it that way. And you can be very, very healthy eating grains, especially whole grain, unprocessed, organic grains, freshly ground, familiar with the whole process, but they still break down. And if you look into the paleo literature, there's a strong network of individuals who believe similarly that staying away from grains is probably wise for your health. And I think it has to do with optimizing your insulin and leptin signaling. So, but if you're going to have grain, one of the safer ones would be quinoa or TEF, TFF or TFT. But something that you can use as a grain that works pretty well is coconut flour. So that's a safer alternative for most people.
Is that something that you could get at Whole Foods?
Yeah, but pretty much any health food store we have it. We also have it on our website, too. But it's available.
It's widely available.
Kroger. Yeah, it's on Amazon. I'm sure it's on Amazon. Just type in coconut flour.
Yeah.
And it's a little bit different than regular flour, but it works pretty similarly.
What do you recommend for sweeteners? I know pure sugar is probably not on your list.
My favorite is stevia. A lot of people have some problems with it because of the aftertaste, but I find the liquid stevias, which you can get pretty much anywhere, are a little more palatable. And I don't find any aftertaste within those. Some people still have a challenge with it. But another newer one is called Lohan, Lohan, or monk fruit. I believe it's a South African herb, which is also a useful one. Some people use xylitol, but you can't use that in large quantities. It's one of the safer sugar alcohols. But those are the three main ones. And, you know, you can use food occasionally, you know, especially if you're engaging in a lot of exercise where you're sweating a lot and losing water, then that would be useful.
So one of the most interesting things that we started off talking about, I just want to end up with it, is the idea that you can improve your body's ability to get rid of fat with a concept called limited fasting. Would you like to review that one more time for those who may have missed that?
Yeah, I think that one of the major misconceptions we have is that breakfast is the most important meal, and I would disagree pretty strongly with that, and I think it's a meal that most people would benefit from abolishing, but it's going to take a while to do that, and it's a process, so that if you normally have breakfast at 8 o'clock, you might go to 8:30 and then to 9, 9:30, 10, and, you know, gradually move it to noon or 1 o'clock, so you basically skip your breakfast. But if you can stop eating 3 hours before you go to sleep, and obviously you're sleeping, and then have that time where you would normally have breakfast, and you can get like the 14, 16 hours where you're not eating, and that by not eating any food and restricting your calories to an eight-hour window, you can really move your body towards being adapted to burn fat as your primary fuel rather than carbohydrates. And that will have an enormous benefit to you because it will give you the power to resist temptations with a lot of these junk foods that you're really exposed to in your social environments. So the hunger for sweets and cravings for it just disappears, and you're able to really choose healthier foods easily, and that's the key, is easily. And one of the best types of foods to do that, I mean, during that eight-hour window when you're eating, you really want to cut down the amount of carbohydrates, the breads, pastas, rice, cereal, potatoes, and increase the healthy fats being like butter, avocados, olives, olive oil, coconut oil. These are foods that will really nourish your body and not impair insulin or leptin signaling, and also improve your body's ability to burn fat rather than the sugar, and then make you leaner and make it sort of really like rolling off a log just to attain your ideal body weight, because two-thirds of our country struggles with weight. They're overweight.
I think that's why this message is so important, because that's something that people can really achieve a lot easier than following diets. These strict diets.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, we're coming up at the end of our hour. Would you like to give your contact information one more time, please?
Well, it's a simple way. It's my last name, and it's spelled N-E-R-C-O-L-A. You just type it in Google or do mercola.com, and then you'll see our newsletter. If you like our information, I've been doing this since 1997, so it's 16 years of content on the site that you can easily access by using our search engine. If you have a question about any topic, you can usually just type it in there, and you'll come up with dozens, if not hundreds, of different articles we've written on the subject. So there's a good resource to use and learn more about the topic that you might be interested in.
Yeah, I want to emphasize it is a research-based website with not only going through the literature, but also interviewing people with experience on the topics, and that the website is a wealth of information. I go to it sometimes when I've got a particularly, you know, obscure question, that often find the answer to it there. But thank you very much for joining us today. You did interview me on the danger of breast implants.
It's fun. Life's a journey, and there's, you know, we'll never know it all. So that's why I really enjoy the opportunity to connect with people who have really dedicated a good portion of their life to one specific area in an hour or so. We can glean the vast majority of that knowledge and the highlights of it and apply it to our own life so that we can reap the fruits of that research.
And that is awfully important, too, because some of us are not able to publish in peer-reviewed journals for a number of different reasons, one being safety. And this helps get our clinical research out. And a lot of alternative cancer doctors and doctors treating specific diseases with alternative methods can share their results on your site, and other people can benefit from it. I don't think people realize, but a peer-reviewed article is often 2 or 3 years behind what's happening clinically at various practices across the country. So your latest stuff is definitely not peer-reviewed.
No. And, you know, we're typically, you know, the most of the information that we're promoting is probably 10 to 20 years away from being widely accepted by the conventional approaches.
Right. But exactly.
We've been doing a lot of it now. So, I mean, some of our earlier stuff is now the norm. You know, like vitamin
right.
D when we first came out, it was just poo-pooed, oh, you don't need vitamin D, and now it's the standard. You know,
exactly.
And there's, I can name a dozen other topics where that was the case. So.
Yeah, well, I think the public will push toward, educating the public like you're doing will push that sooner into
mm-hmm.
the doctor's office, the traditional doctor's office, too, because they'll bring their questions with them. And that's what you're doing. You're educating the public. It's very, very important. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate that, and hope to have you back sometime.
Okay. Well, hopefully you'll be more fat adapted in the future, be able to resist that soda and pizza, and you won't be getting sick again.
There you go. Hope not. All righty. Thank you very much. This is Dr. Susan Kolb with Temple of Health Radio Show. We've been interviewing Dr. Joe Mercola on what you should eat for a healthy lifestyle and diet. See you next week.